You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, Beto's Choice, by Joe Hagen, with photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Former girlfriends describe O'Rourke as curious, wry, bookish, but adventurous. He usually carried a novel in his pocket, whether Captain Corelli's Mandolin or The Sun Also Rises. Maggie Afsahani, an El Paso native who dated O'Rourke while he was at prep school and college, said he was somewhat difficult to know. That's kind of the mystique of Beto, is that he seems to be accessible, she says, but there's just this layer of protection. I don't think it's because he's hiding anything. I think it's because he's keeping a part of it to himself. After he graduated in 1995, O'Rourke and his friends moved to Albuquerque and rented a house formerly occupied by a Swedish ski team. They all shaved their heads and declared this their revolution summer, an homage to the DC punk scene of 1984. The idea was to live on part-time jobs and make art. They formed a band called the Swedes, donning motorcycle helmets and waving the Swedish flag on stage. "I didn't want to make money, didn't want to be in business," O'Rourke says. "My dad was so disappointed. He took out college loans. He knew that I took out loans. I was like, you know, I want to make art. I want to write. I want to make music. I want to create things." The collective fizzled out, however, and O'Rourke has said he became the most depressed I've ever been in my life. After briefly returning to El Paso, during which time he was arrested for attempted forcible entry at the University of Texas in El Paso after tripping a campus alarm one night, O'Rourke went back to New York and started nannying for a wealthy family on the Upper West Side. In 1996, he and a group of friends from both Columbia and El Paso moved into a decrepit loft in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, across from a housing project. O'Rourke worked as an art mover for Headley's Humpers and for his uncle on a startup internet service provider called L.net, building the first websites for PEN American Center and the Committee to Protect Journalists. In Brooklyn, he and his friends threw parties, bashed out punk songs, and drank endless cases of Budweiser. On the roof was a trampoline and a perfect view of the Manhattan skyline. O'Rourke objects to a New York Times story published in February that he believes painted him as aimless and depressed in New York. He describes the time as one of joyous indirection in which he surrounded himself with some amazing artists and thinkers. He read Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey, discovered Bob Dylan, deepened his devotion to the Odyssey, and went through bursts of enthusiasm for bands like Big Star and Guided by Voices. In the parlance of the times, he was a slacker. Generation X is scrappier and less formulaic, observes David Gwynn, a Williamsburg housemate who's now a painter in Philadelphia. Not with a manifest destiny or the heroism of the baby boomers who believed they were going to change the world. There's a real humbleness to the whole generation, and to Beto. "I was waking up in time to go to work, because I had stayed up so late, playing music, having fun, dancing, just being alive," O'Rourke says, "and I don't feel guilty or bad about it, because I'm so glad I did that. It was just such a wonderful time, and I'm so grateful that I had it, but it was not conducive to a career or a discipline or a profession." In a phone call one night, he idly mentioned to his mother he was thinking of returning to El Paso temporarily. She was overjoyed, and she took it as, "This is a great chance to get you home now," says O'Rourke. He was 25. Back in El Paso, his father, Pat O'Rourke, was losing his third consecutive campaign for public office, this time for county judge. Friends were still mystified by his switch to the Republican Party, a self-defeating move in a Democratic town. It was just really kind of heartbreaking, because the entire time you knew he was going to lose, says O'Rourke. The month after O'Rourke returned, he was arrested for drunk driving, an incident that would become a flashpoint in his campaign against Ted Cruz, and will likely become one again in a presidential race. The police report describes O'Rourke driving at high speed and sideswiping a truck going in the same direction, then jumping the median into the oncoming lane at about 2 a.m. According to a police witness, he tried to drive away from the scene of the accident. O'Rourke maintains that this isn't true. I ask O'Rourke to describe the events of that night. He was at home listening to music that evening, he says, when his dad called and asked to meet for a drink at the Cincinnati Bar and Grill. The O'Rourkes drank a couple of Jameson whiskeys. And afterward, O'Rourke called up a college student in Las Cruces that he had dated once, and I said, "Hey, I know this is really late, or late notice, but any chance you're free tonight?" And she was, but she says, "I don't have a ride," so I said, "I'm happy to come pick you up." He drove an hour to Las Cruces, and then an hour back to El Paso to drink with an old high school friend. O'Rourke was taking his date, named Michelle, back to Las Cruces when the accident happened. He failed a sobriety test and was handcuffed. In his telling, he was pathetic, but nonetheless chivalrous. When police left his friend in a gas station parking lot, a handcuffed O'Rourke asked them to take cash out of his jeans so she could get home. His father posted bail. "I think I walked home from county jail that my dad had helped build. I just got home, and you just feel like a total piece of shit, and you kind of are," he says. His license was suspended, and he had to take a bus to his job working at his mom's furniture store. O'Rourke continued playing music, briefly playing in the Sheeps, the YouTube notorious punk band who wore sheep mask and long underwear on stage. But he also came into tighter focus. At the apex of the dot-com boom, he launched his own web design company, Stanton Street Technology Group, with two friends from New York who had followed him to El Paso. To satisfy his creative itch, he also launched an online news magazine focused on El Paso. His father used the site to publish a diary about a cross-country trip on his recumbent bicycle in 2000. One night, in July 2001, the two had what Beto O'Rourke says was the best conversation we ever had, ranging over family, politics, personal history. "We just ate leftovers and drank a bottle of wine in the backyard," he recalls. The next morning, his father was cycling along a quiet route outside El Paso when he was struck by a car and thrown 70 feet to his death. "I was at work, and my mom called me, and I just knew," he says, "because her voice was shaken and said, 'Something's happened with your dad. You should come to the store.'" 2 months later, terrorist struck the World Trade Center, and in the ensuing national alarm, the border between El Paso and Juarez, which his father had crossed freely his entire life, was closed and permanently altered. O'Rourke's father had always dreamed of turning El Paso into the Hong Kong of the border, a nexus for trade and culture. It was a vision that O'Rourke and friends his age in El Paso were starting to talk about in 2001. That year, O'Rourke decided to launch an alternative weekly newspaper, citing his father as the inspiration. Stanton Street died after 15 issues, but it gave him a view into local politics, and Beto O'Rourke began to dream bigger after attending a workshop in Austin organized by Howard Dean. In 2004, he started considering his own run for office. His very first idea was to run for the seat his father had tried and failed to regain, county judge. Instead, O'Rourke was persuaded to run for city council. While plotting his campaign, O'Rourke met Amy Sanders, the 23-year-old daughter of wealthy real estate magnate Bill Sanders. Amy Sanders had grown up in Santa Fe and studied psychology at Williams College in Massachusetts, after which she spent a year teaching kindergarten in Guatemala City. She returned to El Paso, where her family had previously moved, to bide her time while she applied to grad school, but then met O'Rourke through her aunt. They went on a date to Juarez and drank at some of the famous watering holes. "He was giving me reasons 1 through 10 of why I needed to stay in El Paso," Amy O'Rourke recalls. "And I quickly learned that he is just an ultimate El Paso salesman." O'Rourke knew about her father because his mother had once dated him in the 1960s, a double date with Pat O'Rourke, whom she met that same night and eventually married. An entrepreneurial wunderkind as a teenager, Bill Sanders left El Paso in the late 1960s for Chicago and made millions as the godfather of the REITs, Real Estate Investment Trust, and then moved to Santa Fe to build and sell another company. In 2001, O'Rourke heard Sanders give a talk about forming a new business organization called the Paso del Norte, which focused on downtown El Paso. "The group totally captured my imagination," recalls O'Rourke. He was invited to join the group, but didn't, perhaps because he was allied with a mentor, Mayor Ray Caballero, who was suspicious of the largely white and Republican business class. David Crowder, a veteran reporter in El Paso, says Bill Sanders was sort of a great white father coming into town with all this money and ideas for the big boxing of El Paso. Next photo, Rock of Ages, Molly, Henry, and O'Rourke in the music room. In 2005, O'Rourke won his race for city council, advocating for tax abatements to spur development. He married Amy a few months later at his father-in-law's ranch in Santa Fe. Overnight, O'Rourke became the bright, optimistic new face of the El Paso Renaissance, and he supported a real estate development plan that Sanders and his allies had dreamed up, envisioning a gentrified downtown that could attract more people like Beto O'Rourke. The development plans were met with passionate opposition because Sanders wanted to use eminent domain to clear out an impoverished barrio and build a Walmart or a Target. O'Rourke, fluent in Spanish like his father, went door to door, trying to convince residents the city would build affordable housing elsewhere. A local historian and activist, David Romo, accused O'Rourke and his allies of destroying buildings of historic significance to Chicanos and driving immigrants from what he deemed the Ellis Island of the border, a phrase that O'Rourke would later use to defend El Paso against Trump's wall idea. They pointed out that his father-in-law stood to profit from the plans, and indeed, Sanders had formed the Borderplex Realty Trust for just that purpose. The city opened an ethics investigation, and though O'Rourke was cleared of wrongdoing, he recused himself in the public debate and from voting on it. In the end, the plans collapsed because the economy cratered in 2008 and capital dried up. But the controversy stuck to O'Rourke, his original sin. O'Rourke says perhaps his biggest mistake was making an enemy of David Romo, who has become the source for a wave of negative stories in the national press, including the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, I didn't bring David any closer to my point of view, you know. Permanently alienated him, he says. And it was also stupid because I wasn't listening to him. Next photo, show of hands. O'Rourke greeting his people after the celebration of El Paso, February 11th. And border war. As Trump rallied in the El Paso County Coliseum, O'Rourke countered at Bowie High School. In 2011, O'Rourke teamed up with a fellow council member, Susie Byrd, to publish a political tract titled Dealing Drugs and Death, arguing for drug legalization to curtail the cartel wars that had destabilized the border. The tract was nobody's idea of a great political move. Drug legalization was still on the fringes of mainstream politics in 2011, but it set the stage for a run for Congress against the 8-term incumbent Sylvester Arias, a former Border Patrol guard who supported the war on drugs and made his name advocating for border fencing. The odds against beating an incumbent were long, but O'Rourke and his new campaign manager, David Weisong, a local health care executive who had never run a congressional campaign, tabulated the voter turnout they would need to win, which for O'Rourke translated to numbers of doors he needed to knock on. How many doors? How many people behind each door? Weisong recalls. This was the first look at Beto O'Rourke, the endurance athlete campaigner, tirelessly knocking on roughly 16,000 doors. O'Rourke was not without vulnerabilities. Endorsed by both Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, Rice attacked O'Rourke by underlining his alliance with his father-in-law, launching a video ad called Billionaires for Beto. Hoping to retain his positive image, O'Rourke was loath to counterattack Rice, but an outside super PAC, underwritten by Bill Sanders and other business leaders, did it for him, strafing Rice with $240,000 in TV ads that painted the congressman as corrupt, and thereby indirectly lumped him in with several prominent El Paso politicians who had gone to prison for corruption. The ads worked. O'Rourke won by drawing a large number of white Republican voters to his cause, which deepened suspicion from left-leaning Chicano activists. Race begins to play a role in there somehow, recalls Bob Moore, a former El Paso Times editor. So when people talk about Beto's Republican connection, there's a there there. One of O'Rourke's campaign promises was to limit the number of terms he served. Term limits were an issue O'Rourke believed in, but it weakened his hand as a freshman in Congress, where long-term ambition translates to seats on powerful committees. Whereas Rice had been a leading member of the Armed Services Committee, O'Rourke was initially downgraded to Veterans Affairs. He would come to dislike Washington. O'Rourke tried defining himself as an independent voice in Congress, willing to buck party orthodoxy. He co-sponsored a bill with John Cornyn, Republican senator from Texas, to increase border security at ports of entry, and he didn't always vote alongside liberal Democrats. The Guardian, citing analyses on O'Rourke's voting record, concluded that he'd voted with Republicans 167 times over 6 years, and roughly a third of the time in the last 2 years alone. David Weisong calls the story a hit piece from the Bernie Sanders camp. O'Rourke said it was hard to get legislation passed in a GOP-controlled House, but he's proud of bills he helped pass benefiting veterans at Fort Bliss in El Paso, his constituents, and sponsoring legislation to legalize marijuana and to expunge arrest records for people convicted of marijuana possession. O'Rourke voted to let President Obama negotiate the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, which Bernie Sanders attacked as damaging to the working class. O'Rourke now says he would have voted no on the ultimate agreement, but in 2015, he traveled with Obama on a trip to Asia to help build support for the deal. It was his first time on Air Force One. "You could make calls from your seat," wrote O'Rourke in a Medium post about his trip. "I called Amy and my mom and a good family friend." In Vietnam, O'Rourke witnessed hundreds of thousands of people lining the streets of Ho Chi Minh City for Obama's motorcade, the biggest crowds that had ever greeted the then-president. Ben Rhodes, a former White House speechwriter who was also on the trip, wagers that it made a big impression on O'Rourke. Rhodes recalls how Barack Obama once told him that his first foreign trips had opened his mind to the possibilities of the presidency. "I do believe that could put a spark into somebody," Rhodes says. "You're a backbench House member, waiting your turn for questions at hearings, and suddenly you're looking at 100,000 people in Vietnam. You're like, huh, maybe there's a more impactful thing for me to do." When I mention this to O'Rourke, he seems slightly put off, remarking that White House staffers would hardly have remembered him. He recalls thinking of Ben Rhodes. "He probably thinks I'm an intern." O'Rourke drew a distinct lesson from Hillary Clinton's loss to Donald Trump in 2016. He recalled Bernie Sanders joining Clinton for a meeting with congressional Democrats in the run-up to the Democratic National Convention, when Sanders was still withholding his delegates from Clinton and infuriating party elders. He said it's not enough to remind America how bad Donald Trump is. "It's just not going to do it," O'Rourke recalls. "You've got to give people something to be for. It cannot be who we are against." "I think he was so prescient," he continues. "That moment sticks out to me so much because it was so dramatic. He was so hated, really. It's not too strong of a word, when he was in there, and he said the most important thing that I'd heard during that entire campaign." When he decided to run for Senate in Texas against Ted Cruz, O'Rourke planned a purist campaign much like Sanders. No PAC money, no corporate donations, no pollsters, no negative ads, only a revival tent optimism focused on an unabashedly left-wing message. He even hired two forward-thinking field strategists from the Sanders campaign. O'Rourke drew inspiration from punk rock, everything stripped of artifice. "I haven't seen a candidate who has just shared what's on their mind and spoken as honestly and directly without interference from consultants and pollsters as we're doing right now," he told documentary filmmaker Steve Mims early in the campaign. "It may be a brilliant strategy," O'Rourke said. "It may be an incredibly stupid strategy." Promising to visit every county in Texas, he ran his campaign as a marathon of live-streamed political performance art. Road-tripping with a Republican congressman with an iPhone on his dashboard for 36 hours. Air-drumming to The Who's Baba O'Reilly while waiting for burgers at a drive-thru the night he debated Ted Cruz at Southern Methodist University. O'Rourke came off as free of political calculation, as if his charisma were a mere side effect of Beto just being Beto. The tipping point was when O'Rourke gave an extemporaneous monologue defending black NFL players who took a knee during the national anthem to protest police brutality. Now this news packaged it into a viral video, and it rocketed O'Rourke to the national stage. CNN broadcast one of his town hall meetings, and O'Rourke's crowds ballooned. Donor contributions poured in, peaking at $80 million, the most for any Senate campaign in U.S. history. The expanding press pack became more aggressive, to the point where they were knocking the kids and I out of the way to get to Beto, recalls Amy O'Rourke. They were cresting a wave that I'm sure was difficult to stay on, says Emmett Béliveau, a former White House operations staffer whom O'Rourke hired to organize an Austin rally co-starring Beto supporter Willie Nelson. Béliveau, who produced Obama's election night rally in Chicago in 2008, was astounded to discover that O'Rourke's campaign apparatus was mainly just O'Rourke and his cell phone. I kept waiting to get the call from the advance guy, and it never came, he says. That person literally didn't exist. By this time, the idea of O'Rourke as a possible presidential contender was already in the air. Béliveau held a fundraiser for O'Rourke in Chicago, introducing him to former Obama staffers and raising $75,000 for his campaign. Earlier that year, David Weisong had managed to quash a press story saying O'Rourke might run for president if he beat Ted Cruz. Cruz, of course, wasn't empty-handed. By this time, O'Rourke had sold Stanton Street, and his mother Melissa had transferred partial ownership of a shopping center to him before shuttering the furniture store. O'Rourke is said to have a net worth of $9 million. The closure of Charlotte's came after an unusual event. In 2010, O'Rourke's mother's business was indicted for tax fraud, accused of restructuring more than $1 million in cash sales to avoid taxes. The store was forced to pay a $250,000 fine. O'Rourke would blame an accounting error, and his mother never admitted guilt. Friends said it was a simple matter of wealthy Mexican customers paying in cash. But the details were hazy because the indictment was sealed. The Ted Cruz campaign would refer to his mother's store as Charlotte's Web and suggest to reporters that a $640,000 cash sale from a single Mexican customer was related to drug cartels. On election night, O'Rourke and his wife were certain they were going to beat Cruz, even if his polls showed otherwise. One man had flown home from Seattle to vote before polls closed. How could they lose? Recalls Amy O'Rourke, so many of the stories that we had heard, especially in the weeks leading up to the election, you're like, how can you not win? When there is that level of just dedication and passion from so many people that we had met. On election day, Beto and Amy O'Rourke were leaving their house for a packed El Paso stadium when the race was called for Ted Cruz, with only 25% of precincts reporting. I couldn't process how that was possible, says Amy. She managed to maintain her composure until after it was over. The next day, she finally broke down. I couldn't stop crying. The first time I meet Beto O'Rourke, he's lounging on the front veranda of his house on a Sunday afternoon, barefoot in blue jeans and t-shirt, talking on his cell phone. O'Rourke had stopped speaking to the press. He was still kicking himself for giving a damaging interview to the Washington Post, which quoted his prescription for immigration as, I don't know. But he nonetheless waved over a prying reporter and invited me inside to meet his wife and children. His son Henry had a fever, and Amy had fallen asleep on the couch while Dora the Explorer flickered on the TV. There was a Stan Getz LP on the turntable and a plate of homemade scones in the kitchen. O'Rourke experienced a post-election depression like the one he had when he beat Reyes in 2012. He had lost weight, his joints ached, and a stress fracture in his foot curtailed his running regimen. He exercised on his rowing machine and went on his somewhat infamous road trip to interact with regular Americans, trying to work his way through a self-described funk over his loss. Amy bristled at a CNN essay but chastised him for taking an excellent adventure while leaving his wife and kids at home. I was a little insulted, because it implied that I couldn't support our family. His stream of consciousness posts, which Amy edited, were mocked on Twitter, an outlet that O'Rourke criticizes as mean. No human, least of all me, is strong enough to completely withstand the impact that has on you, and it can't be healthy, he says. The week O'Rourke lost, Barack Obama called him and congratulated him. He just said, "Hey, you ran a great race. If you're interested, I'd love to sit down and talk with you." During their meeting at Obama's office in Washington the next week, it was O'Rourke who brought up the idea of running for president. I raised it with him. "Some people who I really respect have asked me to think about running for president," O'Rourke recalls. He asked about, "What will this do to my family? Is this the right thing for the country? Do I see a path to win? Do I see something that I uniquely can provide for what the country needs right now?" By the time I met O'Rourke again in February, he had nearly found his answer. Concerns about his family had abated, despite Henry's protestations. "I'm not as concerned about our ability to make it as a family as I might have been 3 months ago," says O'Rourke. The week before he was to appear on stage with Oprah Winfrey in New York, he had what he describes as a breakthrough conversation with his wife. He stayed up until 3 a.m. to plot his future. "I was excited to think it through," he recalls. "And, well, if we ran, what if we did it like this? Or we could do this?" He got up 3 hours later and went running. When O'Rourke blurted out to Oprah that he'd make a decision on whether to run or not before the end of this month, the answer surprised even him. "I did not intend to say that," he tells me. On the flight home from New York, O'Rourke learned that Trump was coming to El Paso. Amy was reading Becoming by Michelle Obama, absorbing the former First Lady's account of her trials, living through a toxic presidential race with her husband. By the time the O'Rourkes touched down at El Paso International Airport, Amy's stomach was in knots. "She was kind of pissed at me when we got home," recalls O'Rourke, "almost like you, effer." She knew he was running. Beto O'Rourke will have to define himself against a crowded field of Democratic candidates, but he doesn't feel the need to draw blood to define himself. "I just don't get turned on by being against," he says. "I really get excited to be for. That's what moves me. It's important to defeat Trump, but that's not exciting to me. What's exciting to me is for the United States to lead the world in making sure that the generations that follow us can live here. What's exciting to me is figuring out something that has eluded us for so long. How do we make sure every single person can see a doctor in this country?" he adds. "That's really exciting to me." Pressed on his national policy positions, O'Rourke says he wants to shore up the Affordable Care Act and make Medicare part of the health care marketplace, and eventually make health care for all a reality. He would also make climate change a top priority. "Keeping the planet from warming 1.5 degrees Celsius, for me, is the most important for humanity," he says. He supports Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal in spirit, if not every letter. "The goal of converting to 100% renewable energy within a decade, I love," he says. "It's ambitious. It captures your imagination." As if to rebut the inevitable accusations that he's a socialist, he proclaims himself a proud capitalist, among the few Democratic candidates, he points out, who have been small business owners. "The ingenuity and innovation that you only find in America and in capitalist systems, the ability to harness the power of the market," he says. "It's hard to argue against pricing carbon and allowing the market to respond to that." He also believes in a version of Ocasio-Cortez's call for a higher top marginal tax rate, though he doesn't volunteer the 70% number, and he makes a different sort of argument. If you're trying to mobilize this country to meet an existential threat, as we did against the Nazis in World War II, then you're going to have to ask everyone to sacrifice, he says. If you don't see a shared interest or shared opportunity to advance, then we'll no longer see ourselves in this together, and this country will truly break apart. This level of gross income inequality cannot persist, and if there's a better way to get there, I'm open to it. But it's definitely going to involve higher marginal rates on the very wealthiest in this country. His biggest strength, of course, is his unique credibility as a voice on immigration. O'Rourke wants to end the war on drugs, raise the cap on work visas, find a pathway to citizenship for illegal immigrants, and create a system with the Mexican government that would track who was in the country. In my opinion, that includes citizenship for dreamers, a legal path to citizenship for their parents, and the ability to get right with the law, and work legally, and pay taxes, and pursue a path to citizenship for millions of others who've been working the toughest jobs here. For some, O'Rourke can still seem politically indistinct, even slippery, but that may be part of his strategy. When asked if he's a progressive, a question that will surely dog him in the weeks to come, O'Rourke hedges with the aplomb of Barack Obama circa 2008. I leave that to other people. I'm not into the labels. My sense in traveling Texas for the past 2 years, my sense is that people really aren't into them either. Positions on issues matter, of course, but they aren't everything. Indeed, in the Trump era, it may well be that harnessing intense voter passion is more important when facing a bombastic cult of personality who draws on Fox News rage ratings. Beto O'Rourke is selling the idea that he can unite the country by playing nice with the kind of people he met in rural Texas on his Senate campaign, middle Americans who had barely met a Democrat, let alone considered voting for one. But O'Rourke also sells a kind of cult of personality of his own, offering himself as the David to Trump's Goliath, a folk hero for our time. He acknowledges that what has made Trump successful is also what has made him successful, an outsider who bent the media to his campaign, as he put it. But unlike Trump, O'Rourke can appear almost too innocent to be a politician, too decent, too wholesome. The very reason he became popular, also the same reason he could be crucified on the national stage. I tell O'Rourke that perhaps he's simply too normal to be president. Whether you meant it or not, I take that as a compliment, he says. It's 10:30 p.m., and Amy is now curled up on a chair next to Beto, scrolling through emails. The kids are asleep. I ask O'Rourke if he could see himself among the presidential biographies on his shelf. Washington, Lincoln, Kennedy. I haven't really thought about that, he says. I think ego-wise, we're going to be okay if we don't run. Where we won't be okay is if we don't run and come to the conclusion later on, if we had run, man, this wouldn't have happened. Things would have been a lot better. Or, you didn't do everything you could, Amy says, completing his sentence. We didn't do everything that we could, he says. Beto O'Rourke seems, in this moment, like a cliff diver trying to psych himself into the jump. And after playing coy all afternoon about whether he'll run, he finally can't deny the pull of his own gifts. You can probably tell that I want to run, he finally confides, smiling. I do. I think I'd be good at it. This is the fight of our lives, he continues. Not the fight of my political life kind of crap, but like, this is the fight of our lives as Americans and as humans, I'd argue. The more he talks, the more he likes the sound of what he's saying. I want to be in it, he says, now leaning forward. Man, I'm just born to be in it, and I want to do everything I humanly can for this country at this moment. A month later, Beto O'Rourke announces his run for the White House. Thank you. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Dr. Henry Louis Gates, Jr., the producer and host of the docuseries Reconstruction, America After the Civil War, and author of Stony the Road, talks calligraphy, hitchhiking, and history. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Late one Sunday afternoon, my 3-year-old granddaughter, out of the blue, took my hand and said she wanted to whisper something to me. Could we go for a ride around the block before we all sat down for dinner? Just the two of us? Holding hands as we walked to and from the car in the driveway, bliss. What is your greatest fear? That we will be remembered as a people who locked our fellow citizens in cages, and who believe that some people are rich and some people are poor because it's their nature, and that racism and poverty are inevitable parts of the order of things, that MLK and Bobby Kennedy died in vain, and that no one any longer believes what MLK said in his Nobel Prize address in Oslo. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new, however, is that we have the resources to get rid of it. Which historical figure do you most identify with? I most admire W.E.B. Du Bois, for the same reason that MLK did. One idea he insistently taught was that black people have been kept in oppression and deprivation by a poisonous fog of lies that depicted them as inferior, born deficient, and deservedly doomed to servitude to the grave. So long as the lie was believed, the brutality and criminality of conduct toward the Negro was easy for the conscience to bear. The twisted logic ran, if the black man was inferior, he was not oppressed. His place in society was appropriate to his meager talent and intellect. Dr. Du Bois recognized that the keystone and the arch of oppression was the myth of inferiority, and he dedicated his brilliant talents to demolish it. But there was only one Du Bois. I don't identify myself with him. I admire him. Which living person do you most admire? It's a tie between Vernon Julian Jordan Jr., Wally Soyinka, and Oprah Winfrey. All are fearless. All know themselves. All have examined themselves, and all are comfortable with what they have seen. What is your greatest extravagance? Signed first editions in dust jackets by pre-Harlem Renaissance writers, and suits made by a London tailor. What is your favorite journey? Then hitchhiking across the equator with Lawrence Biddle Weeks when I was 20. Now the drive to the ferry at Woods Hole on July 1st. What is your greatest regret? Not realizing that I was never meant to become a medical doctor or a lawyer sooner than I did. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Producing films and writing about the historical experiences of black people. When and where were you happiest? Well, I'm happiest on Martha's Vineyard between July 1st and Labor Day, riding my tricycle with Larry Bobo every afternoon and fishing with Buddy Vanderhoop. But I was happiest from my childhood through high school in Piedmont, West Virginia. It was magical. I was sorry when it was time to go off to college. Which talent would you most like to have? I'd love to be able to do Japanese calligraphy and slam dunk a basketball. What is your current state of mind? I'm worried that Donald Trump is not an aberration, but the beginning of a trend. Here's a Vanity Fair spotlight by Amy Fine Collins, Tootsie's brand new bag, with photograph by Thomas Pryor. Red Letter, Santino Fontana and William Ivy Long, in the part of the costumer's New York City studio designed to simulate the visuals from a theater's 8th row. When director Scott Ellis asked Santino Fontana to play the title role in the new musical comedy Tootsie, based on the 1982 hit movie, the star had two requests. He wanted his character, Dorothy Michaels, the female alter ego of an unemployed male actor named Michael Dorsey, to have a southern accent. And he insisted that at some point Dorothy wear the signature red sequined tootsie dress. For Dorothy's spoken voice, Fontana channeled a softer Laura Bush, and for the figure-hugging glitzy gown, he placed himself in the hands of costume wizard William Ivy Long, who confected a total of 20 looks for Fontana's female persona. As a result, Fontana says, he has discovered what it feels like to walk, quite literally, in a woman's shoes. If you are trying hard to identify with what women are going through, and you still don't understand, this show will be very helpful, he promises. Fontana learned to sing in a constricting corset, something his wife reminded him women have had to do for hundreds of years. Yet the show's balls-out comedy, as composer and lyricist David Yazbek quips, does not ever come from the sight of a man in a dress. Rather, the humor arises from book writer Robert Horne's bullseye deployment of zingers and the cast's infallible delivery of them. About the farcical nature of the show, opening in April at Broadway's Marquee Theater, Horne says, if you can get people to laugh, you can get people to think.
Thank you.
This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.